Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Dark Matters by Michael Dow. Narrated by Graham Halstead. 1. Man holds in his mortal hands the power to abolish all forms of human poverty and all forms of human life. John F. Kennedy. At 128 miles per hour, it was no small feat to look away from the road, even for an instant. But Carl stole a quick glance, catching sight of his wife and daughter, asleep in the seats behind him. He still wasn't sure why they had changed their mind and joined him, but he was glad for the company nonetheless. He had chewed through the Long Island Expressway, 70 miles from Manhattan to the Manorville exit in barely half an hour. Leaving Manhattan at 3 in the morning certainly helped, as did his regular donations to each of the myriad police departments along the way. The darkness didn't deter him either. Carl had been driving this route for 30+ years. He knew the road like he knew every crease and crevice in his favorite Italian leather jacket, now folded neatly on the seat beside him. Carl Wilson, for over 15 years the CEO of General Resources Incorporated, didn't consider himself reckless, and though some of his colleagues might have disagreed, he saw the drive just as he saw his time at GRI, as a series of well-calculated and manageable risks. Even now, as he left Route 111 and accelerated up the ramp to Route 27 for the final leg to their weekend home, he reflected on the vehicle at his command. At a time when even the common man could nearly afford an auto car, Carl still preferred to have his own hands on the wheel. In this case, a sophisticated array of controls that put nearly every function directly at his fingertips. It was a degree of control that suited him well and befitted the CEO of the world's first multi-trillion-dollar conglomerate. To be sure, it was no ordinary auto car. The custom-designed machine had set him back over $8 million. It included a multitude of performance and safety features, from polymer resin and carbon fiber body panels that stored the electric power, to an onboard control system that monitored and even anticipated his every move and command. But the real cost had been in a handful of extravagant extras, like the Claytronic seating. His shape-changing seats could be configured in an infinite number of positions. Even now, his wife and daughter were ensconced in a pair of perfectly contoured, lie-flat beds. They would sleep safe and sound until they reached their destination. He continued his acceleration up the ramp and merged onto the empty highway. Before long, the open fields on either side would give way to more populated towns, forcing him to slow down. So he pushed the accelerator further, enjoying a final few minutes of exhilaration. He'd had more than his share of adrenaline over the past 24 hours, but another small dose was always welcome. As the car barreled down the last stretch of open highway, Carl's mind wandered to the events of the previous day. In all his years as CEO, he could count on one hand the number of arguments he had lost. And he didn't intend to lose this one, even if it was with the chairman. The two of them didn't argue often, but when they did, the sparks flew. This so-called endgame that the chairman had proposed was a non-starter, as far as Carl was concerned. And he had no intention of backing down. He could only hope they would reconsider the request. In the meantime, he had made his position clear. All he could do now was wait, and take some much-needed time off. A long weekend would do him wonders, especially when it included Barbara and Lily. With Lily's college graduation less than a year away, there were precious few of these opportunities still remaining. He was determined to take advantage of them. They were just passing over the Route 24 interchange, Carl's landmark to begin a gradual deceleration. Beyond that was Shinnecock Canal, the unofficial gateway to the Hamptons. His house was a secluded retreat in Montauk, at the eastern end of Long Island. Over the years, he had seen more than his share of drunken fools on this final stretch of road, even at this hour. So he released the accelerator, allowing the car to reduce speed over the mile-long span leading up to the bridge. Strangely, the car didn't slow. Carl put his foot on the brake, applying light pressure with the ball of his foot. There was no response. He pressed harder, feeling another surge of adrenaline through his veins. If anything, the car was now going faster. He looked out the window as they gained speed. The tall pine trees were a blur, flashing past in a rush. He pumped the brakes again, using all of his weight. Still nothing. He disabled the autocar system, punched the ignition button, and even tried the windows. It was all for naught. On both sides of the road, guardrails appeared. The bridge over the canal was rapidly approaching. In an act of desperation, he wrenched the wheel to the right, hoping to slow the vehicle by grinding it against the guardrail. But the wheel wouldn't budge. All his effort didn't cause the car to veer an inch from its course. Time slowed. Carl turned to look once more at his wife and daughter. They were serene and beautiful as they slept in the seats behind him, headphones in place, blissfully unaware. He couldn't bring himself to wake them. White noise crashed through his head. The rush of blood was becoming more than he could stand. He turned to the front, just as the car swerved sharply toward the guardrail on his right. With a dull thud and a jolt, the guardrail gave way, offering oddly little resistance. The car careened through the opening, plunging toward the trees below. Carl's last thought formed around a single, ineloquent word. Bastards. 2. The snake which cannot cast its skin has to die. Friedrich Nietzsche. Rudy paced the length of the foyer, searching hopelessly for that elusive link between patience and virtue. Across the room, a wide marble staircase curved to the second floor of their Manhattan penthouse and to their master suite. His wife, Victoria, was still up there, and he knew better than to yell up those stairs. Instead, he paused his pacing and took another deep breath. From where he stood, a large picture window overlooked Central Park and the city skyline to the east. It was a view that precious few residents enjoyed, and yet it did little to improve his mood. Instead of the brilliant fall colors, he saw grays and browns as cement and dirt continued its inexorable march across formerly grass-covered fields. The irony wasn't lost on him. No money to water the grass in Central Park, but billions for flood walls to keep water away. Only a fool could avoid connecting the dots. New York politics at its best. His gaze returned to the street far below and the traffic running along Central Park West. As far as he could tell, there was still no sign of his car. He triple-blinked, activating the net overlay built into his contact lenses. It was past 4 o'clock. They would be cutting it close. His eyes darted left, opening a local map display. He saw his car just a few blocks away. The thinnest of smiles crossed his lips. Small victories. A quick stare at the close icon, and the display disappeared. Rudy turned and stole a look in the foyer mirror, running a hand through his gray-flecked hair. He was ready, at least. As he resumed his solitary march, a familiar chirp came through his earpiece. Reflexively, he reached up and touched the device. Though most of his colleagues now had a communications implant, Rudy still wore his earpiece tucked neatly against the bone just behind his right ear. He liked the feel of it, the physical presence of the technology. And after 30-plus years in the business, he wasn't about to embed another company's product into his own body.
"I'm here, sir."
The car had arrived, though more than 10 minutes after he had sent the signal. They were going to need extra time to get across town. He took one more look up the stairs, shook his head, and turned toward his study. He could buy Victoria a few extra minutes if he said goodbye to the kids while he waited. The study doors were closed. He pressed his ear against the small crack between them, listening for signs of activity. He strained to decipher the muffled sounds, hushed whispers, a rustling of paper, perhaps even a giggle. The girls had claimed to be doing homework, but he'd bet money they were messing with the nano-replicator he'd just brought home from the office. He pushed the doors wide to a scene of flailing arms, wide eyes, and 2 teenage girls brandishing looks of unadulterated innocence.
"How's the homework coming, ladies?"
"Hey, Dad, are you and Mom leaving now?"
His younger daughter, Shay, was a master of the deft subject change. The slight tilt of the head, the disarming smile, and the gleam in her dark brown eyes only added to the effect.
"We are," Rudy replied.
I wish we could go to the funeral,
Rudy's older daughter, Sonia, chimed in.
Lily was our friend, too.
Rudy considered the question again, though he and Victoria had already discussed the topic at length. Lily had been the girl's favorite babysitter, but she was also the only daughter of Rudy's longtime boss and mentor, Carl Wilson. The tragedy of the accident was still sinking in.
I know you'd both like to go, Rudy said, but it's going to be mostly adults and crowded. It's better that you stay here.
Truth be told, Victoria wanted the kids to join them, but Rudy had put his foot down. Given yesterday's announcement of his promotion and the inevitable awkwardness that might come as a result, he wanted to be able to control the environment. And his girls, as much as he loved them, were about as easy to control as New York City weather.
We'll vid you on the way back so you can pretend to be doing homework when we walk in.
Humor was Rudy's way of changing the topic. He knew full well where Shay had gotten her subject-shifting talents.
Very funny, Dad, Sonia said. We'll be done before you get back, don't worry.
Sonia was the diligent one. Rudy knew she'd at least make the effort.
Rosie!
Rudy directed his shout toward the kitchen. Rosie was the family's primary homebot and another perk of Rudy's position at GRI. He had a soft spot for Rosie, having led the efforts to develop key aspects of her learning algorithms many years ago. So although Rosie's torso and limbs were regularly upgraded with the latest technologies, her knowledge and personality had been with them for years. Rosie also managed the rest of the Dersch household homebots. Rudy couldn't imagine life without her. Rosie soon appeared at the study doors, striding into the room with an ease that spoke to her state-of-the-art kinematics and the sophistication of her artificial muscles and joints. Her degrees of motion, in fact, now far surpassed that of any human, as did the capacity of her artificial intelligence brain. She stopped next to Rudy, awaiting further instruction.
Rosie, make sure the homework gets done. You can help, just don't do it for them. You know the rules.
Rudy pointed to the machine on his desk.
And be sure they leave the nano-replicator alone, he added. No new puppies while we're gone.
Dad,
Shay said. She was rolling her eyes, though a small smile also escaped her lips.
Love you, ladies,
Rudy said as he blew them each a kiss and pulled the study doors closed. They would be in good hands with Rosie. Rudy returned to the foyer just as Victoria was descending the stairs. She looked as radiant today as she did on their wedding day, almost 20 years ago. Tall, lithe, and classically elegant, her knee-length black dress included a modest V at the neck, sleeves to the elbow, and a stylish pattern of crisscrossed straps across her upper back. Accented with thin black gloves and a simple pearl and diamond pendant necklace, she looked every part the wife of a newly minted CEO. Rudy soaked in the view. No way a guy from South Jersey deserves that. He had worked hard to get to where he was, but he knew that luck had played just as big a role. Like the night some friends had dragged him to a charity event hosted by Victoria's parents. He had been lucky that day, in both love and life, he recalled with a grin.
The car is here. We should get going.
Rudy grabbed two coats from the closet.
Have you spoken to the girls? She replied, looking down the hallway.
I did. They're fine. Doing homework with Rosie.
Rudy knew it was a partial truth, but they'd been over this topic before.
No harm, no foul, he liked to say.
Bye, girls. Love you,
Victoria shouted toward the study as she pulled on her coat. Rudy was already out the door, waiting for the elevator. At the street, the doorman rushed to hold the car door for them. He was the third or fourth doorman this year. Rudy had lost track. It didn't help that they seemed to come and go like the wind and at the whim of the building residents. Rudy tried his best to remember the names, but it was no easy task.
Thank you, Cedric.
Victoria, of course, had always been good with names. Rudy smiled and slid into the seat next to her.
18 minutes to destination, sir.
Rudy had already provided the destination, but he'd like to reconfirm once in the car. His was pure auto car, without a steering wheel or even a front seat. Technically, he and his wife were in the front seat, with another row for the kids behind them. It wasn't his first fully automated model. He hadn't wrapped his hands around a steering wheel in years. He just didn't see the point. Rudy leaned forward. Bond, confirmed destination. 460 Madison Avenue. The car's command word didn't have to be customized, but Rudy found it amusing to be chauffeured around the city by a 20th-century British spy. He'd even watched a few of the movies. Rudy had an affinity for 20th-century culture. He had named his homebot, as well as his assistant, Grace, after obscure television and movie characters from that era.
Confirmed. 18 minutes to destination, sir.
Bond accelerated into the heavy traffic on Central Park West, a move aided by his real-time link to the other auto cars on the street. It was only the few idiots still driving their own cars that caused problems these days. Rudy wished they would ban them from the city, once and for all. The trip to the church was relatively short. Rudy watched the city flow by, listening to the hum of the streets and the cacophony of sounds that made the city so unique. He couldn't imagine living or working anywhere else. Of course, his version of living was a bit out of touch with the vast majority of city residents, all 25 million of them. He felt no guilt about it. He had clawed his way to the top from almost nothing. Though, admittedly, he had a hand up from a few others, like Victoria's family and Carl. But that was how it worked. The fact that the same feat was all but impossible today wasn't Rudy's problem. If it was his to do over again, he'd find a way. He was sure of it.
This whole thing feels so surreal. Victoria's comment brought him back from his musings. Are you ready for the funeral? And all the rest of it?
He could see the concern at the corners of her eyes and in the turn of her lips, but he could also hear a touch of pride in her tone. Ready as I'll ever be. I know Carl wanted me to have the job. I just wish it could have come some other way. The circumstances behind Carl's accident continued to baffle him. No one had seen it. No one had heard it. And no one could understand it. Carl had been driving that stretch of road for years. Decades, in fact. The investigation had discovered a malfunction in the controls of his multi-million-dollar custom auto car. It wasn't merely tragic. It just didn't make sense. Some of the best engineers in the world maintained that car. And that was only the beginning of the whirlwind. The past week had been the most intense of Rudy's life, as the tragedy was quickly supplanted by the inevitable office politics amongst the remaining GRI senior executives. It had all come to a head yesterday, less than a week later, with the formal announcement of Rudolf Dersch as Carl's successor and GRI's new CEO. They arrived at St. Patrick's Cathedral 20 minutes early, just as he had planned. The auto car stopped on 50th before reaching Madison, dropping them at a side entrance. Rudy helped Victoria out of the vehicle, which then disappeared to find parking. It would stay close, thanks to the price-is-no-object setting he used in the parking parameters. Turning away from the curb, the two of them quietly slipped through the 50th Street entrance. Inside, the grandeur of the church took hold of him. Rudy wasn't Catholic, or even particularly religious, for that matter, but Carl had been a longtime fixture in New York's Catholic community. That, along with a sizable donation to the latest restoration efforts, was enough to secure St. Patrick's on short notice, though they had to settle for a Thursday afternoon. The sanctuary was massive, and yet it was already close to full. Rudy took a deep breath as the significance of the moment began to set in.
"We should find a place to sit," Victoria said.
Rudy watched her scan the crowd as she escorted them toward the center of the church. His eyes caught sight of the caskets, all three of them, dominating the broad expanse of the altar. Even the vibrant colors of the stained glass windows, flashing vivid hues in the afternoon sun, couldn't distract from the somber scene. They worked their way through the crowd to join the rest of the GRI executives. Rudy did his best to engage in small talk as they walked, accepting a mixture of congratulations and condolences, though the sincerity was occasionally lacking for the former. Of course, a few of them had thrown all their chips on the table and openly lobbied for the CEO position. They knew the likely consequences. Rudy did little to hide it, holding their handshake just an awkward moment too long and giving them his best see-you-next-week greeting and big, phony smile. But all the while, it was hard for Rudy to ignore Carl's presence. The sooner the funeral got started, the better. Victoria led the way to the front of the church, where they found seats next to GRI's chief operating officer. The woman only hesitated a moment before sliding over, giving them the aisle. Victoria gave her an appreciative smile before turning back to wink at Rudy. The funeral service was about to begin. After the service, Rudy exited to Fifth Avenue, where they joined the rest of the attendees. The funeral had been poignant, most notably one of the eulogies delivered by Lily's childhood friend. It had been a good decision to leave the kids at home, he was sure. Rudy was still shaking hands and talking with a few colleagues when a long black sedan fought its way through the traffic and pulled to the curb. A door opened, and a portly older man with a cane struggled out of the car. He ambled directly to where Rudy was standing.
"Good to see you, Rudy. Sorry we aren't meeting under better circumstances."
Arthur Knowles was a member of the GRI Board of Directors, a position he had held for several years. Rudy had met him on numerous occasions, but had gotten to know him significantly better over the past few days. He had the slightest of British accents. Arthur had been raised in London, but spent the vast majority of his career in the United States.
"Hello, Arthur. Good to see you," Rudy said.
"Might I have a word with you?" Arthur said. "I'm sorry to bother you on a day like this, but it is a pressing matter. If it could wait, it would."
Rudy looked at Victoria, then back to Arthur. "Let me first send Victoria on her way." Arthur shook his head.
"Actually, Victoria can stay if you'd like. She's family, right?"
Rudy shot Victoria another glance. She remained in place, waiting impassively.
"Of course," Rudy replied.
Arthur leaned in, close to Rudy's ear, lowering his voice below the din of the crowd.
"We have a bit of a crisis," he began. "In part due to the recent change in leadership. Without boring you over the details, there are some activities underway that need immediate attention. Things that Carl was personally overseeing. I'm pulling the details together now, but I'm afraid we won't be ready until tomorrow evening. I do apologize. I know it's a Friday. The whole thing shouldn't take more than a few hours."
To her credit, Victoria didn't react. Rudy could guess what she was thinking, but she would let him handle it. And most likely she'd handle him later. He took a quick moment to consider the invitation. He knew it wasn't really a request. Someday he'd learn when he could say no, but one day into his tenure as CEO wasn't that day. "Arthur, I'm happy to help. How about tomorrow evening, say 6 o'clock?
6 o'clock it is. And I promise not to keep him out too late."
He gave Victoria a grin, though it appeared a bit forced.
"That would be great," Rudy said. "I have a 9 o'clock virtual reality date with the girls. Big trouble if I miss it."
"Excellent," Arthur replied. "I'll see you then."
Arthur shuffled back to the sedan. A moment later, it pulled away from the curb and disappeared. Rudy turned back to Victoria. They began to thread their way through the dwindling crowd and toward their car.
"Nice move with the 9 o'clock thing," Victoria said. "The girls will be thrilled to hear about the date."
She gave Rudy the smallest of smirks.
"Just trying to establish some ground rules," Rudy said. "Are you complaining?"
"No, as long as you're actually back by 9.
"I'll do the best I can, but you know how that goes."
Rudy paused for a moment.
"Maybe you'd better not tell the girls I said 9 o'clock. I'll surprise them."
"Well, you're right about one thing. If you're home by 9 o'clock, you'll certainly surprise them."
Rudy knew where this conversation was going. Better to shift gears now.
"Look, the car is already here," he said.
Bond was waiting at the curb, having returned to the precise spot where it had left them. Rudy opened the door. Victoria slid inside. He climbed in behind her as she continued to look at him.
"Thanks for the help today," he said.
"You were fantastic." He took her hand and gave it a squeeze. Just to be safe, he leaned in and gave her a kiss.
She gave him her patented, lucky I put up with you face. He wasn't fooling her, he knew. But apparently she was going to let him get away with one, this time at least. Rudy turned to face the front of the auto car. Bond, take us home. Bond signaled his acceptance and pulled away from the curb. Giving directions to his British spy-turned-driver never failed to put a smile on Rudy's face. 3. Art washes away from the soul the dirt of everyday life. Picasso. Don't give me that look, Monique said, stepping back from the 19th-century Degas self-portrait she had been wiping down with a soft cloth. Despite her warning, Degas did nothing to avert his stare. I know where you live, she added, pointing a finger. Degas remained unimpressed. Monique smiled as she continued to wipe down the painting. She enjoyed her time alone in the gallery. As both manager and curator, she had plenty of it. Her back and forth with Degas helped pass the time, and occasionally even led to small moments of self-discovery. Today, however, her debate with Degas was interrupted by a customer, a tall, slim man who pushed his way through the front door. He strode purposefully to the center of the room, glancing about as he walked. He wasn't someone she had seen in the gallery before. Monique remained where she stood, covertly watching the man as he took in his surroundings. She gave him a minute to browse, and approached only after his third or fourth furtive glance in her direction. Monique was hard to miss, a tall, exotic beauty with long, dark hair and an athletic build. Her olive complexion and pale blue eyes, flecked with hints of gold, made her mixed heritage difficult to decipher. She was in her mid-30s, but guesses at her age were often wildly off base. She gave the man a warm smile, crossing the room and extending her hand. Welcome to Art and Soul, she said. My name is Monique Durand. Are you looking for something in particular? He shook her hand, offering a curt smile. He was clearly a man of wealth, a custom-tailored charcoal suit, expensive watch, shoes polished to a mirror shine. All the clues were there, even for someone without Monique's keen eye. But most of all, it was in his stare, the practiced look of seeing right through people he deemed beneath him. Monique recognized that sign almost immediately. Actually, I need something for a party. My name is Charles. Charles Jones. Monique nodded. Is this a gift? She asked. Can you tell me a little about the recipient? No, sorry. It's our dinner party. A fundraiser for a friend. My wife wants something new for over the mantle. Says it will help raise money. Charles glanced around the room, settling on a portrait that hung on the far wall. How about that one? He said. She looks a bit like my mother. He pointed to the painting. They crossed the room together, stopping a few feet from the painting. This is a work by Robert Henry, she said. He's a well-known 19th-century American artist. His work is still on display in a number of galleries, including one here in Washington, D.C. This one has an interesting story. Yes, yes, perfect. How much? Monique was beginning to wonder whether the man even cared about art. Most likely he cared to the extent that it matched the window treatments and didn't clash with their latest taste in furniture. She did some quick calculations. It's a unique piece, she said. I'd need to go check, but I'm sure it's north of $4 million. Is that in the range you were looking to spend? How about we say 4.5 and call it done? Monique paused, considering the offer. She was sure he'd pay more if she pushed him, but that meant she'd have to spend more time talking to him. Are you able to purchase it right now? She said. Charles walked to the small counter and pointed to the scanner. Fire away. Monique followed behind, punching her code into the terminal as she turned to face him. She touched the screen and retrieved the Henry painting. Her quote had been right on the mark. With all the taxes, the total is... she began, but before she could complete the sentence, Charles interrupted her again. Oh, and I do need that delivered. The party is tonight. Did I mention that? He pulled a card from his pocket and handed it to her. This is the address. Monique looked up as she took the card. I'm sorry, but I'm the only one here.
We could most likely deliver it sometime tomorrow, but I won't know until the morning. Sorry about that.
Charles' voice took on a more formal tone. I really need...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?